the strongest statement that I think we could get against TPP. We did not come out with a total rejection of it, but we set up standards that it clearly does not meet. And said that we that any trade agreement must meet these standards. Which
we're going to talk about
meet.
The rest of the platform and post it online at democracynow.org. Congressmember Ellison, thanks so much for joining us.
KABU at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, Right to Survive, Breaking the Chains, will play Thursday, July 14th at 7 p.m. The night will give an inside perspective of the struggles of the houseless community and showcase a series of short films documenting Right to Survive's origins in 2009, Direct Actions, and its annual Pitch a Tent Campout, which protests the city's hypocrisy when it comes to allowing sidewalk camping for the Rose Parade. Many of the Right to Survive board members will also share their experiences and talk about the process of moving to their new location. Again, that's Right to Survive, Breaking the Chains, Thursday, July 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thursday, July 14th, Shocks of Sheba will be broadcasting live from Fire on the Mountain as part of KABU's 25-hour membership drive marathon. Tune in from noon to 4, or join us in person at Fire on the Mountain at 57th and Fremont in Northeast Portland. TJT from KABU's Youth Collective will be joining us, blending his original hip-hop with the reggae vibes. It's community collaboration and celebration. That's Thursday, July 14th, from noon until 4 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the fallout continues from the fatal shooting of five police officers at a rally in Dallas last week.
Portland protesters may have narrowly avoided a shooting scene as well. We talked to Teresa Rayford about the Don't Shoot Portland protest last week.
And a new book is released tomorrow about white privilege. We speak to one of the authors.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, July 11, 2016. I'm Jamani Ward-Lewis.
And I'm Ken Jones. Last Thursday, a peaceful demonstration in front of Portland's Justice Center was momentarily interrupted when a white man pulled and aimed a gun at the protesters. The rally led by Don't Shoot PDX was in response to the recent police shootings in Minnesota and Louisiana. The shootings resulted in the deaths of two black men. The march was one of the many Black Lives Matter protests that have occurred across the nation in the past week. The armed man was identified as Michael Strickland, a local conservative blogger who's a contributor to the YouTube channel Laughing at Liberals. Early in the rally, Strickland removed a gun from his pocket, backed away from the protest, and repeatedly aimed his gun at the crowd. No shots were fired. Strickland claimed self-defense, saying that he felt threatened by protesters, but attendees claimed that Strickland pulled the gun before there was any physical contact. He had a round in the chamber, a full magazine, and five extra magazines in his pockets. Police were called after Strickland pulled out his gun, and he was arrested shortly after they arrived. This is not Strickland's first altercation with community members. Prosecutors claim that last month, Strickland made threatening phone calls to an attendee at a candlelight vigil honoring the victims of the Orlando nightclub. At a court appearance on Friday, a prosecutor stated serious concerns about community safety were Strickland to be released without supervision. Strickland's being held in Multnomah County Jail without bail, with bail set at $250,000. He's been charged with two felony counts of unlawful use of a firearm, as well as the misdemeanors, menacing, and second-degree disorderly conduct.
The Dallas Police Department used a bomb to kill sniper Micah Johnson and ended a standoff in a parking garage. This marks the first time domestic police have used a lethal robot for the specific purpose of killing a suspect. The decision to use the bomb was made by Dallas Police Chief David Brown with the agreement of Mayor Mike Rawlings. Specifically, Brown told the mayor that officers would use a remote-controlled robot to detonate a brick of plastic explosives. This is believed to be the first time a chief has ever made the call to use explosives to kill a suspect and end a standoff. Although few people question the need to end the standoff, many wonder if the use of a bomb against a suspect has set a dangerous precedent. KBOO's John Paccio has more.
Dallas Police Chief David Brown made a statement standing by his use of an improvised explosive device to kill the suspect Micah Xavier Johnson, the former Army veteran who killed five Dallas police officers on Thursday during the Black Lives Matter protests. The device used is a Northrop Grumman Rometic Andros used by police officers and military to defuse explosives. Dallas police ended the standoff by attaching 1 pound of C4 to the robot and detonating it in the parking garage where the suspect was engaging police, killing him instantly. The incident raises questions about the legality of any police force using explosives to engage suspects. Jay Stanley, a policy analyst with the Texas ACLU, wrote a statement to KBOO News about their opinion on the situation. Quote, "It is difficult for us to comment on what happened in Dallas because we don't know all the facts. What we can say is that it might be justified to use remotely controlled robots to apply lethal force where such force is justified. As a legal matter, the choice of weapon and a decision to use lethal force does not change the constitutional calculus, which hinges on whether an individual possesses an imminent threat to others and whether the use of lethal force is reasonable under the circumstances. That said, because ground robots may allow deadly force to be applied more safely and easily, they raise the danger that they will be overused. When things get easier to do, they tend to be done too much. Remote uses of force raise policy issues that should be carefully considered and addressed by our society as technology advances and should remain confined to extraordinary situations." End quote. I'm John Pacheco with KBOO News.
Black Lives Matter leader DeRay McKesson said mounting criticism from the political right is an effort to deflect attention from the need to improve police accountability. McKesson made his comments the day after his release from jail in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He was among more than 100 demonstrators arrested Saturday in Baton Rouge while protesting the police shooting death of Alton B. Sterling. He was charged with simple obstruction of highway commerce. Conservative commentators such as Rush Limbaugh, Sarah Palin, and Rudy Giuliani have claimed that the Black Lives Matter movement and protesters are escalating tensions and racial divide. In a Monday interview on Fox News, Giuliani stated that Black Lives Matter was inherently racist and divides America. In a particularly incendiary comment, Giuliani said, quote, "They don't mean Black Lives Matter. They mean let's agitate against the police." McKesson later said that critics of the movement were doing everything in their power to distract the nation from continuing the difficult conversation about police brutality and racism. In addition to being a leader in Black Lives Matter, McKesson is one of the founders of Campaign Zero, a policy platform to end police violence.
As we just reported, a man was arrested Thursday for pulling a gun and pointing it at people who were peacefully protesting against violence and police brutality. We have in the studio today one of the organizers of the demonstration, Portland activist Teresa Rayford. Teresa, what happened in the Don't Shoot Portland protest last week?
We had just made it over to the Justice Center, and there was a pretty big crowd, maybe about 1,100 to 1,200 people that were out there. But over to my right, I noticed that there was some type of situation that was happening with, you know, some of the people that we utilized for security measures at our protests, a couple of our anarchist friends and people that are from, like, you know, Cop Watch blogging. I noticed that there was some type of issue happening over to the side of the protest. And since we had so many speakers, a lot of the people were still listening to the speakers, and so they weren't alerted to it. But as a lead organizer, I needed to walk over and check it out. And so what I saw was that there were a couple of trucks of police officers, you know, down the street, because we're at the Justice Center, so they're right there, kitty corner to where we are. But at the same time, directly in front of us, there was Michael Strickland, who's laughing at liberals, and a couple of my comrades engaged in what looked like, you know, him pulling out a gun and them reacting to it in a way to de-escalate what was happening. And I was thinking to myself, like, well, they're familiar with this person. They probably are already initiating a talk, and I can see that they're moving it over further away from the families. And at the same time, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, and the police are right there, and we're in front of the Justice Center, so somebody's going to go and start de-escalating that. And me as a lead organizer, I can go near the bullhorn, so once I see de-escalation happening, if there's a need for an order of mic check or any type of safety signal, that I would be in a position to provide that guidance for the people that we were organizing with. And so we witnessed what ended up happening, and we know now that it was Michael Strickland, and that he, you know, not only was there with the gun out, but that he also had six magazines for, I guess, what he said was his protection. So
exactly. Teresa, were you able to recognize Michael Strickland? Had you seen him before or heard of him? I know you've been at KABU a lot. At the KABU studios, we actually have a picture of him behind the front desk here as a kind of a known troublemaker.
Absolutely. Well, I've been aware of him probably as far back as 2010. I gave testimony in City Hall during Mayor Adams' reign as mayor in regards to some gun legislation that was going to happen here locally after my nephew's death in September of 2010. And so I was familiar with that organization or some of his networks, because after I did initial testimony, I continued fighting for gun legislation. And so he was a part of a network of people that I was vaguely familiar with as far as their insight on, you know, the Second Amendment rights, but also, you know, kind of harassed and things like that on social media. But I never, I don't engage with trolls. I call them a troll. I see them at the protest. I don't violate free speech. And I just keep myself out of that. But just, I was just telling Lisa that when I came up here for an interview a couple of weeks ago, I saw the picture of him in here. And I thought to myself, like, wow, if everybody's, you know, putting this image out and everything, I don't know what's happening with it, but I'm not going to pull myself into it, because I've seen the call-out culture that activists engage in. And really, for lead organizers like myself, it becomes a serious safety issue, because it leaves us wide open. We're the most known people that the public has access to. And so even right now, there's white supremacist sites that are coming up, and they have Don't Shoot Portland, and that's registered in my name. And so if they have an issue with Black Lives Matter out here, I'm a person. I don't have a big group of community that's going to stand around and take bullets if some NRA person feels like we violated his Second Amendment right. And, you know, it comes all different ways. So it's pretty complex right now.
Nice. I want to shift gears a little bit. I wanted to know your thoughts on the shootings of police officers in Dallas.
Well, I don't condone violence in any form or manner. I hate gun violence most of all, because that's how I lost my nephew and several of my family members. And so to me, it's there. This is the thing. When we were at our protest, we were protesting police brutality. When the people that were there, the protesters, the family members, the children, when they were there, they were protesting police brutality. When the officers were there that morning, when they left, they knew that when they put on their gear, when they had that job, with everything, that their job is to protect and serve us. So I'm thinking that in their world and in the culture of their industry, that they have some type of thought process that every day they're putting their lives on the line. The thought is to me, though, that my child, when going to the store or the park or school, that intention is not to put their life on the line. That intention is to get there safely. And I'm always hoping that our police will help our society be that safe. And nothing has changed to make our society safer since the Dallas officers were gunned down. And so it is not helping what we're working for.
Back to what happened in Portland. What was the lasting repercussions for you of the gun incident at Don't Shoot Portland?
What was the last? What do you mean?
Like the overall repercussions.
Are you more fearful now? Do you have more security at, or will you have more security at these events, for example?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, we talk a lot in the activist culture about safe spaces, and we want to build spaces around where we can go and be safe against all the hurt and pain in the world. And there are no safe spaces for any of us. And that's something that we all need to continue to realize through all the work that we're doing and to continue discussing. And so the protest that I have organized for Wednesday is not anything that has to deal with the fear factor, but it's mostly for safety and community so that we could possibly just do a big live nonviolent direct action training and talk to people about the protocol of coming to the protest and even safety measures for online promotions of your issues or your feelings about things. We've done a lot of organizing over the last couple of years, so we've learned a lot of things that we can share with the community so that they can feel safe when they come to protest and they can learn about the culture of keeping each other safe and identifying things that might not be safe. So that's probably more than what, you know, a lot of people expect, but we need that to happen in order to continue to protest.
Now, we reported a little earlier on the news that the gunman, Michael Strickland, was actually arrested by the police at the protest. He's charged now with two felonies, two misdemeanors. I think he was released on bail. Is that did the police act in the right way, responsibly during the protest, would you say? There was no overreaction, apparently.
Well, there was no tasing, there was no rubber bullets, there was no pepper spray, there was no, they didn't even speak loudly to him. He didn't get beat up, he didn't get choked out, killed, murdered. He was taken into custody just like Dylan Roof and a couple of other people that have been out on the front line with guns, you know, armed individuals here in America that have been taken into custody alive and unassaulted by law enforcement. So we're in Whitelandia. If we wanted to prove out the privilege of police brutality and excessive force, then that was a prime example, because that same day they used excessive force in killing someone that had, you know, committed shootings in Dallas. So the reaction is not the same. That truck that I saw when I went down to investigate the situation myself hadn't moved. It was looking in the same direction that I was in, and these are police officers in full riot gear sitting not even a couple of feet, you know, blocks away from what was happening, and they weren't even alarmed to see this white man raising his gun and waving it at a crowd of about 1,100 white, black, Asian, Hispanic community members, Muslim, all colors, at a Black Lives Matter protest, which we know across the nation, we've heard about massive shootings, slayings, people targeting and harassing and killing Black Lives Matter activists. And there's no concern from the Portland Police Bureau. We were just on that step saying, bring out the chief, because we wanted to talk to the new chief of police. And he hasn't even contacted us to find out if we're safe. I talked to Mayor Adams Hill's office over a year ago, talking about the issues with the safety and the bullying and the online things. And they said even if the FBI was tracking us, that they wouldn't interfere. And that's pretty clear. The police didn't even interfere. Our guys took them down. They de-escalated the issue.
What is the reason the police give for not interfering?
They haven't contacted us. They haven't reached out to us to find out if we're safe, if we've been receiving any threats, if there might be some need for additional investigation. I mean, nothing. No witness accounts. I know that they're dealing with a lot of the people that were directly involved in it. But as a protest organizer that's known by our law enforcement agencies, you would think that they would take the time to be considerate about our health, welfare, and safety. And so that's why we're bringing it to the park on Wednesday. We're out here by ourselves. I left ACLU earlier, you know, talking to them about next step measures, because no one has reached out to us. The only person in government or that had relationship was Mary Nolan, and she came to me and spoke to me and told me that we as a government need to do something more to engage. And so I'm just hoping that it happens at some point.
Oh, who's Mary Nolan?
Mary Nolan. I ran against her for city commissioner a couple of years ago, against Amanda Fritz as well. And she was a state rep for about 17 years. And I think she's the executive director for Planned Parenthood. So just like others, I've asked for community members and organizations and agencies to reach out to the leaders and asked them to make statements, you know, just to support activism and also to denounce the actions of police assaults and brutality and excessive force. Just make a statement and let people know that we're not criminals because we're using our constitutional right.
Oh, Teresa, we have only have a minute left. I just wanted listeners to know about the little bit more about the protest at Dawson Park.
Oh, absolutely. So it's going to be Wednesday at 3 p.m. We're going to be meeting under the gazebo. There's a lot of little barbecue grills, so we're going to have hot dogs and hamburgers. We're expecting a lot of people, so we're asking people to bring additional food. We're going to have farmers handing out fresh, clean fruit and vegetables. And then we'll do a march with our community, but we're asking people to come out, bring their voices, and be willing to stand in support and solidarity with community while we discuss safety measures and just community engagement.
All right. Thanks, Teresa.
All right. Hey, can I say one more thing?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Today is the anniversary of the death of Sandra Bland. So I just wanted to say that Sandra Bland, her life did matter.
Yes.
That was Teresa Rayford. For those of you who forgot about Sandra Bland, she was arrested for not signaling, turning left in Texas last year about this time. And she died a few days later in jail under mysterious circumstances. I don't think that's been cleared up to everybody's satisfaction at this point. That was Teresa Rayford again of Don't Shoot Portland. You can find the group on Facebook under Don't Shoot Portland. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline. This week, host Karen James interviews Ray Fox, who was released from the Oregon prison system in 2015 after serving 30 years for murder. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, increasing clouds with a low around 59. North-northwest wind 3 to 7 miles per hour. Tomorrow, a chance of rain before noon, then showers afternoon, high near 70. Chance of precipitation is 80%. Today in history, in 1977, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was posthumously awarded the Medal of Freedom in a White House ceremony. And in 1995, the United States normalized its relations with Vietnam. The quote of the day is by former President Jimmy Carter, who said, "We will not learn how to live together in peace by killing each other's children."
In Baton Rouge, tensions boiled over during the weekend as riot police clashed with demonstrators angry over police violence. It was in Louisiana's capital that 37-year-old street vendor Alton Sterling was shot dead by police officers, sparking nationwide renewed protest against the disproportionate killings by police of people of color. Jesse Hardman with Free Speech Radio News brings us the story.
Hundreds turned out in downtown Baton Rouge to march against police violence in the city where 37-year-old street vendor Alton Sterling was shot and killed by a police officer a week ago. Planned marches were peaceful, many even coordinated with law enforcement. But police began cracking down on demonstrators they said obstructed local roadways. By the end of the weekend, nearly 200 people had been arrested. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards said he was pleased by what he considered law enforcement's moderate response to the weekend's events.
If orders are made not to obstruct a roadway and you step out into the road, that is cause for arrest. Period.
Back in downtown Baton Rouge, many protesters were trying to avoid getting arrested. 23-year-old Brittany Will sprinted away from police and riot gear across the street.
We just standing there on the sidewalk. Police and everybody come geared up in their SWAT uniform and everything. Everybody started running. sheriffs started coming our way.
You can't even stand
started
on the
running.
You've been given lawful orders to disperse. You must disperse or you will be arrested.
As dusk fell Sunday, riot police and a few hundred protesters faced off in a residential street. Police demands to disperse were ignored by many. Across the city, at another protest in front of police headquarters, 41-year-old Baton Rouge native Cleopatra Dunn checked in with her daughters, all of them wearing white Alton Sterling t-shirts. Sterling, she said, was robbed of his life by police. And the officer responsible, she said, must be held accountable.
This time next Sunday, hoping that justice will be served because what took place was uncalled for.
The U.S. Justice Department said it's taken over the investigation of the fatal shootings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, the 32-year-old Minnesota man shot to death following a traffic stop in suburban St. Paul. People here in Baton Rouge say they'll continue to turn out in force until there's meaningful change in relations between police and the communities they're sworn to protect. Jesse Hardman, FSRN, Baton Rouge.
The killing of a young man in late May of this year by Gresham police has touched off protests. Bodie Phelps was just 22 years old when he was shot and killed by two Gresham police officers. The officers claimed they saw two knives, despite witnesses saying otherwise and no weapons were found. Within seconds of arriving on the scene without warning, the officers fatally shot Bodie in the back as he ran. With us this afternoon to talk about the situation is Bodie's mom, Shiloh Phelps, and a family friend, Louise Curtis. Thank you both for coming in to KBOO today.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Oh, Shiloh, first, could you tell us a little bit about your son, Bodie? What was he like?
My son was friendly, kind. My son, if you met him, he would have treated you like anybody else, no matter what, where you came from, what you did. He gave everybody the notion that everybody was the same. I'm gonna get a little teared up.
We understand.
My son, I've received many compliments on my son over the last 6 weeks, more than I can even prepared for, telling me how wonderful my son was and how he touched everybody's life, whether it was NA or HA or if it was at the local deli barn. My son was wonderful to everybody.
I should mention it would have been his 23rd birthday.
Yesterday would have been.
Yesterday.
Correct.
It was very sad. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us from your point of view and what you found out from witnesses, what happened that day in May when Bodie was shot and killed?
Okay. So in May, that day in May, the day before, he had an argument with his girlfriend and she was made to leave my house. When he eventually caught up with her that night and they started arguing again. And apparently it was over either a phone call that was made to him from somebody else. I'm assuming a girl. I'm not quite sure. At that point, there was a flat tire, and he fixed it. Now, that's when the screaming started. And she was
And this upset. Was at the apartment where his girlfriend lived?
No. They were visiting a friend. Uh-huh. And this is point A, I guess, that we've been calling it point A, over past Stark. And then the argument continued on, and she was screaming, and which she would could get very vocal. Unfortunately, the people around the apartment complex heard the screaming and thought she was in trouble. So once they got in the car, they took off, went down to the point B where off Grant and 188th, I think it was. Down there, she started screaming again because the flat tire was flat again, the second flat tire, and he couldn't get it fixed. So he walked over to a friend's house. It was pretty late that night. The friend, his mother didn't recognize him because it was so late, and she sent him off. He went back to the car. She's still screaming, and that's when Bodie heard that she had called the police officers, and he took off running. Unfortunately, there's fight or flight. My son always ran. And because he was, of course, scared. And he had some, he did have some, other interactions with officers, throughout the last couple of years. And his theory was that if he ran, that they'd eventually catch up with him because they knew who he was. But if he was using it at that time, at the point of time when he was being chased, he would have to go into jail and detox. And I'm not sure. I've never had to.
He was addicted to heroin at the time.
Correct. Uh-huh. And I don't know about any of you, but I've heard it's horrible. So
it's usually cold turkey, and
right.
Could be very painful.
Correct. And so he would run, and understandably, I guess.
Well, this time he had grabbed two cases of beer. Now, in the police reports, you don't hear of anything about the beer. You see a picture of the beer in the very first reports out. I think it was like KTU, I believe. But you hear nothing about it. He was carrying those two cases of beer with him as he ran down, as the cops chased him. One case dropped 1 point, another case dropped another point. Then, of course, after that, he got shot. Within a minute and 30 seconds, I think it was, from the time that he went back to the car to the time he ran with the beer, he was shot.
So according to witness reports that you've talked to, at no time did he stop and actually run towards the police?
Absolutely not.
He was running away
and
then dropped the beer to go a little faster, I would imagine.
Correct. That's what I'm assuming. So, and then there was 11 shots. Now, in the police reports that we heard about, they mentioned the last shot was, they had 11 shots listed on the coroner's report. We haven't yet seen any reports, by the way. There's been nothing in there. We haven't seen nothing, but only what we heard. The very last shot said a shot to the buttocks in the back. I'm assuming that this is done on purpose, because if they would have said it was in the front, in the very first shot, if they would have put the buttock shot in the very first shot, then everybody would know that he was shot in the back first. So I'm assuming he was running. They shot him in the back, and then he got shot 10 more times in the front. He, as he laid there dying, I know that they tied his hands behind his back, and the cops did not try to give him CPR. The ambulance got there, and shortly after he died.
So there was a grand jury that declined to indict the officers. They did an investigation. They called it a justified shooting, but you haven't seen any of the evidence that grand jury looked at or uncovered.
Correct. We've seen nothing.
So we don't know for sure whether the police claimed Bodie was running at them. You'd figure that the shots would be entering from the front.
All of them.
But there's no evidence that there were any shots from the front. They were all from the back.
Or, no, there's,
or
there's,
we haven't seen
we
that
haven't
yet.
Seen that yet. Oh. Now, from what they said there's shots in the front. But the shots, if you look at the aerial, there's an aerial photo. If you look at them, the shots are awfully close, and they're around his body. So, I mean, there's some of them seem like they're maybe like 2 or 3 feet. Why in the hell would they have to shoot 2 or 3 feet, you know, away,
right.
You know, 2 or 3 feet away? I have no idea.
They also claim that he was armed with two knives, but there were witnesses that reported, including his girlfriend, that he had no knives on him.
Correct.
And there was one that he actually stuck into a tire, she
right,
said,
that was
according
the first
to her report.
The first flat tire, yeah.
So the police claim that he was running at them with the knives, even though witnesses said that he was unarmed and actually running the other direction, away from the police.
Correct. So as he carried the two cases of beer, he's supposed to have two knives and a cell phone as well, right? And then he's supposed to do some, or if he had them in his pockets, some ninja move and whip out the two, you know, knives. There's no way. I mean, there's absolutely no way. My son was very particular about what he wore. Okay, this is another thing. He would never put anything in his pockets. I mean, everything down to his shoelaces. He would never put anything in his pockets to make sure that if they ripped. They said they had a butter knife at one point. There's no way to put a butter knife in his pocket. He would be feared that it would rip his pocket and stuff would fall out. And that's how anal my son was.
And it's not exactly a fearsome weapon,
right.
A butter knife.
Right.
Now, the prosecutor in this case, then, it was his responsibility to get an indictment of the officers. Do you feel that he just didn't do his job properly? There were some ulterior motives why he wanted to exonerate the officers?
I can tell you, less than 10% of police officers in our situation are indicted. So how can we get accountability from police officers if the DA is having lunch with them the day before and then going to court the next day? They're all friends. We know this. They all work in the same field. They all work for the law, you know, for law enforcement. They all work for the law, for the courts. There is no way that the DA actually went after these officers. I can't imagine.
I should also mention, fortunately, there's been cameras in several killings recently. In fact, two brutal police shootings last week. There were cameras, the body cameras, I guess we didn't see yet, but there were actually witnesses taking cell phone video, and there was some surveillance video available that made the story a little clearer, other than what the police officially reported. Was there anything like that in Bodie's case?
No, there wasn't. Unfortunately, they're saying that Gresham police don't have body cams or police cams, which I can't imagine why, considering that the area that they're policing is Rockwood, which is supposed to be the worst as far as gangs are concerned. So, you know, why would they not have these items? I mean, either they don't want accountability. You know, they don't want us to know what goes on. That's what I'm thinking. Or, you know, and we know that the funding's there. They have the money to do it. I mean, we know for a fact they just got brand new cars. You know, that's not the reason. So, there's nothing for us to draw on. No. As far as cams go, nothing at all.
So clearly there's a lot of questions still to be answered. Apparently they were supposed to be answered by the grand jury, but the public is not privy to that information, at least not so far. So there's a petition on change.org calling for a special prosecutor to be appointed in the case to investigate Bodie's death. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
All right, I can. Well, first of all, I was not invited to the grand jury. In fact, I don't think there was anybody on Bodie's behalf invited to the grand jury. It consisted of officers. His girlfriend did go. I know that. So I guess she would be, you know, on Bodie's behalf. However, that would be the only one. The other ones were witnesses that they talked to right after the incident. And we have no idea what was said. Okay, so what we're looking for is we want somebody that will make them accountable, that they can have their own investigation. Instead of the DA... It took him 2 days or 2 weeks actually to go to grand jury, and then 2 days to decide there was no indictment. And there needs to be change. We have to have somebody else besides the cops investigating the cops, or the, you know, somebody else not in that realm. So either we have a citizens board that investigates. I mean, there's got to be some kind of change, because if we don't, we'll never have accountability ever.
I was going to ask then, what's your next step here? And is it to try to get a special investigator, a different kind of prosecutor than the one that prosecuted the case before the grand jury?
That we would like to get that done. I'm from what I'm hearing, that's impossible.
Oh, why is that?
Well,
the case is like closed shut now?
Pretty much, that's what I'm hearing. So I'm not sure how that, we've got to look more into that and see. Hopefully the ACLU can help us out. My attorney hopefully can help us out. But we're not, as far as I know at this point, that's kind of the case is closed against the police officers. We want to gain momentum. We want to bring groups together. We want to request to have, you know, body cams, dash cams in all the police cars in Oregon for accountability. We also want to, what else do you want to do? I'm a little nervous.
I understand.
We're trying to coordinate now. I mean, I've had 6 weeks to grieve, and that's not even long enough. But now I feel like I can kind of function a little more outside of my own home and start working on these, you know, on these questions that you have proposed.
Have you talked to other mothers in similar situations? Are there support groups for you? And
I've talked to many, many mothers. I've gotten many messages on Facebook, many phone calls. It's very sad, and the same thing over and over again.
Oh, one last thing, Shiloh, and again, I know this has been difficult for you, and Louise, thanks for you coming in too. Do you have a website or some other way for listeners who support this work or would love to see more information on this case? It seems, again, mysterious circumstances here. If it was answered definitively by the grand jury, why not make that public?
Correct. We have a hashtag, Justice for Bodie. Go on Facebook and look up Justice for Bodie, B-O-D-H-I, or Bodie Phelps, P-H-E-L-P-S is the last name. And you can find all the information there. We will have a website soon, though.
Oh, thanks very much, Shiloh. That was Shiloh Wilson Phillips and family friend Louise Curtis. Shiloh's son, Bodie, was unarmed when he was shot in the back and killed by the Gresham police on May 25th.
And now we check in with Stevie Alapan, a journalist exploring the legacy of colonialism through a trip back to his roots in Puerto Rico. Read all his writing on his blog, I Will Not Obey, on blogspot.com.
This is a program about Puerto Rico and its people, their relationship with the U.S., and their experience living under colonial rule. This is the story through our own eyes. This week, we meet with Victor Torres, a communications committee member of the Campamento en Contra la Junta, a civil disobedience camp occupying the entrance to the federal courthouse in Atoré, Puerto Rico. The camp is a response to the coming fiscal board. Victor tells us about the junta, federal repression, and reparations.
I work in communications with the camp. Apart from that, I am a part of the people that have been staying at this camp for most of the time, developing the alternatives to colonial rule and to austerity politics. This camp has started with an open convocatoria, a calling for when that said that when the project was approved, that we will come to protest in front of the camp. After that protest, we decided to have an assembly, which was the one that declared this camp. It was established last week, Wednesday, the 29th of June. Yeah, the day that the Senate approved the Promesa project. The day that the Senate decided to approve it, we decided to come here because we have already heard that President Obama was willing to sign the project, and we believe that we couldn't wait any longer. Well, the fiscal board is basically a group of people, seven people that will be elected by the President of the United States, seven of whom only one has to have residence in Puerto Rico. And considering the laws that I was talking about, Law 20 and 22, it will probably be one of those billionaires that has been attracted here by those tax exemptions that will be part of that, a person from the island that will be elected there. The fiscal board will be basically the one that drafts suggestions and that will be the last saying in the plan fiscal, the fiscal plan for the year. There are a lot of places that say that this fiscal board cannot legislate, but there are parts of the law that say that if the fiscal plan doesn't comply with the demands of the fiscal board, then the fiscal board can declare that plan illegitimate. The people on the fiscal board cannot be brought to court for any reason, so they're basically immune to any types of investigations or any types of court cases that could be brought up by the citizenship on any case. It may deregulate local and federal environmental standards. This last one is under the decision of the governor of Puerto Rico to make, but both candidates from the major parties have explicitly and publicly said that they would govern with the board in compliance with the decisions of the board. And it would basically be to lower the minimum wage of the people under 25 to $4.25 an hour. It should be made explicit that the cost of living in Puerto Rico is way more expensive than anywhere else in the mainland U.S. And lowering the minimum wage of the youngest people is not a policy of promoting decent jobs for these young people that are entering the job market. Right now, the salary of $7.25 doesn't make ends meet. People at the end of the month find themselves having troubles with paying their bills, with paying their food, with paying their education. If you mix that up with recent plan that has been made to raise the tuition rate of the public university and recent taxes that have been implemented to consumption, which are taxes that affect the less privileged of the society, it is a politic of impoverishment of the people of Puerto Rico, especially the young people. $4.25 literally not be a salary that will make people survive in this island. It is also a strategy that would make people older than 25 more prone to be fired from their jobs, so that people younger than 25 could be contracted at a lower cost. That will also make the salaries in the job market in general, not just for the people under 25, go down. It is important that people denounce all of these activities of the fiscal board because it not only impoverishes the people of the island, but it also limits even further the right that the people of Puerto Rico have to self-determination and self-rule. There are instances of repression against the people of Puerto Rico, especially against independence movements. As recently as 2006, the FBI assassinated a pro-independence leader, Filiberto Ojeda Río,
in an illegal intervention, it is important that we denounce all these attempts of repression and intimidation by the colonial authorities over the people of Puerto Rico. An example of that more recently is that while we were here in this camp on Saturday at 12 in the morning, the authorities of the federal courthouse took electric generators and put the exhaust pipes of said generators in direction towards the camp. We went to them and said that these generators were giving off fumes that were damaging our health, and they said that we should call 911. When we called 911, they told us that there was nothing that they could do about it. We asked them to move them again. They said that they couldn't move them because they needed some machinery to do so. We went as an act of self-defense, of peaceful self-defense, with a sign that said SOS and with a plastic cloth to cover up the fence that was just in front of the generator so we can be protected from these fumes. At least 10 to 15 people had to leave the camp. We are now going to go to the courts to process the federal authorities for damages to health. The thing is that when we went to get close to put this cloth, federal authorities basically came out with pepper spray. They didn't do anything, but they came out with rifles. We, in that time, decided to retreat. When the media came along, they started moving the machines manually after they said that they couldn't move them without some machinery. That is indicative that they knew what they were doing, that they were actively intimidating and intoxicating people that were defending peacefully their right, their constitutional rights, because even though we live under colonial rule, we are still U.S. citizens. Our constitutional rights and the constitution of the ELA establishes it too, to free association and free expression. The ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, and Amnesty International denounce these attempts of intoxication. Right now, generators are still active. Some of them are looking towards the camp, some of them are not, but they're not as close as they were that night. It is important that we stay vigilant to any attempt of repression against the people of Puerto Rico, especially those people who are resisting these